Welcome to our new visitors in the Kaivalya cocoon. I hope that you are able to perceive the satsang here in the lodge of the Mahatmas who have all gathered to shine with divine light and share the joy of self-realization. You're very fortunate, however, to be in the cocoon. And I hope you realize that it is a Kaivalya cocoon, and I hope you understand the meaning of that. Was that explained in the orientation?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow, okay. Well, I'll give you a hint tonight, so you can already be in Kaivalya before, without waiting another day. It's that state it's a term in Sankhya philosophy, which is one of the philosophies of classical yoga, of the Patanjali school of yoga, in which the goal of the process of meditation is to extract purusha from prakriti. Prakriti is nature, including the ego, including the ego's thoughts, and because they are all produced by the other, by the natural world, the social world, the family system. The other is the master of the ego. The ego is a slave of the other. It's born as a slave because it's a helpless child, and the giant adults control its destiny. And so they tell it all kinds of things that the ego naively believes that only later turn out not to be true, and it still goes on believing them, even when it knows they're not true. So you have to extract yourself from all of the illusions that the mind has been filled with by misinformation, disinformation, and fantasies, projections, internalizations of the projections of other people, and the sense of lack that is carried by the ego because it has forgotten who it is, and it's dependent on the other to tell it who it is. And it's dependent, therefore, on approval and positive projections in order to feel good about itself. And so this is the cause of transactions at the ego level. But what happens is the ego becomes corrupted because it wants to have power over others. It doesn't want to be a slave. It wants to be a master. And so in order to get mastery, the ego realizes that knowledge is power. Now, that's true at the higher level. At the lower level, it thinks it's true. It turns out it just creates karmic suffering. But because the ego believes that power comes from knowledge, it pries into the affairs of others in order to know as much about them as possible so it can use that information and manipulate people and situations. And it uses that to increase its power. And it uses gossip to increase its power. And it uses negative projections to feel superior to others. It does all kinds of things that are not true, not good, not healthy, and that undermine a communal trust and harmony. And those things must not happen in an ashram. That's why we come here, to purify ourselves of ego. The Kaivalya state is that state of purity where you have extracted the soul from all the impurities of the ego's false nature and return to your real eternal nature, which has no such blemishes, no such sanskaras, no such tendencies. Now, everyone who's a resident at the ashram here has already done that. No one here engages in gossip or pries into each other's affairs, right? Well, they're working on it. But you who are visiting, don't let them pry into your affairs or engage in gossip with them or get into egoic collusions. Don't make the mistake of falling into bad habits. Stay in Kaivalya and be a role model to those here who still have some traces of ego. But don't come out of that cocoon of solitude. That's what Kaivalya really means, the aloneness of realizing the oneself. And if you stay in that state, you will be immune to any negative vibrations that you might accidentally encounter. Okay, I hope that's useful to not only the newbies, but I hope that everyone really takes to heart the importance of extracting yourself from any such tendencies of the ego, because that is the worst kind of undermining of a community that can happen, and when that goes on, it creates fissures, shockwaves, cracks in the unity of the superorganismic spirit of wholeness that we are vowed to sustain. And we have to keep our vows in order to achieve liberation. Not liberation only from the ego for an individual soul, but liberation for all as a single being. Because everyone is a fragment, a microcosmic instantiation of the one self. And so we must all rise together into that absolute wholeness. And we must not project any negativity. And we must not engage in those kinds of activities, because people imitate each other. And if one does it, others will do it. And they will justify it by saying, oh, but they're doing it, so I can do it. And then once that happens, then the negative, vicious circle increases in its velocity. And eventually it destroys not only communities, but it's destroying the whole planet at this time. The same thing is happening at a level of societies and of international politics and at every other level. But it must stop first in the microcosm of the ego. Without that purification, there can be no feeling of at-homeness in the universe. There can be no feeling of oneness with God that makes the heart feel safe and secure so that it can open in unconditional love. Otherwise, it will remain defended, it will remain paranoid, it will remain suspicious, and the vasanas, the samskaras, of playing ego games in order to have power will continue. And they will ultimately backfire, as they always do, whether at the political level of the planet or of the individual level. They'll backfire and create suffering and a destruction of the beauty of life. So, that's the sermon for this evening. But I think that more importantly than that is not to miss out on the real power and the real knowledge and the real bliss of the Absolute Self that each of us is a manifestation of, and not to fall into belief in the ego's narratives that will tell you, no, I can't be that. I'm not good enough. I have failed in this and that, and I've done these horrible things and all of this that disqualify me, or I'm not even interested because I want more enjoyments on the phenomenal plane before I want God, because God is death and I don't want to go through ego death. I want to, because the ego wants to stay alive and it wants to continue to receive all of those enjoyments of the illusion of power and pleasure, which always turn into their opposites. And so it's only if you understand the pendularity of the phenomenal plane, that everything does turn into its opposite. And only if you have unified those two polarities and all the multipolarities of all the pairs of opposites and transcended them, can you live in the phenomenal plane in alignment with the Tao, in stability and in coherence, and without distraction and without being pulled off your center and fall into some quicksand of Maya. So I hope everyone is gaining or has already gained the wisdom to avoid those traps and has learned how to have the real power, which is mastery over the ego mind, and the power that enables you to eliminate the ego mind and abide in the blissful silence of pure presence, and then download the thoughts of God's mind. Then there's real brilliance, there's real genius, there's real wisdom and understanding and bodhisattvahood, and the ability to then be a purifier and an uplifter and an angelic server of the Supreme Intelligence. May you all achieve the grace, the benefits of that level of consciousness, which is what will restore our whole world to a kingdom of heaven. And only that. Only the real, only truth, only the power of abiding in and as the truth can bring about such a transformation. Does that make sense to everyone? I hope so. It doesn't to most of the world. But that's why you have left the world, you have renounced Maya, and you've come here in order to become a bodhisattva, a Buddha, a realized being, an avatar, a sage, a spiritual guide for others who are on the path, who will gain from your own experience and imperience of defeating Maya and going through the rite of passage of ego death. So, I hope that all of you are close to that or realize it now and are manifesting the power of the divine light and love and the freedom of that infinite compassionate intelligence of the heart that is our real nature. Now, the second reason I've come this evening is that I want to announce that we are long overdue to have a Sangha-wide book group. We haven't had one in a long time. How many of you would like to read together another interesting book? Yeah? Okay. A few hands didn't go up, but okay. And once you see the book, more hands will go down because I'm going to offer you a very advanced book that I'm not sure how many of our members will actually be interested in reading. So we can offer it to some if they want to attend, but I do think that this book is for people who want to increase their intelligence, who are willing to think deeply and read slowly and probably several times some of the passages in this book and really reflect upon what is being proposed, what is being implied, what is being pointed to symbolically. Because, as I say, it's a very profound book, and it's written by what I think someone I think is one of the finest scholars of the contemporary scene, maybe one of the last of the great minds who have been able to integrate not only Western philosophy, but Eastern as well. It's a woman. Her name is Edith Visegrád. She's from Hungary, or at least her parents are from Hungary, but she's a Western scholar. And her central focus is phenomenology, but it's really the entirety of the Western philosophic canon. And she is at heart a Buddhist. And she has integrated that that Buddhistic understanding of emptiness. And so the book that I have chosen, and she's written many books, actually, but the one I've chosen is for a particular reason. One of the other books of hers that I was tempted by was a book on the question of, is it possible for a Pomo to become a saint? And, well, I'll let you read it yourself to discover the answer. It's rather complex. But she describes what postmodern sainthood would have to be given the conditions of the ego structure that needs to be transcended and the tenaciousness of determination that is required that previous saints growing up in the feudal system or in the classical world didn't have to deal with. And so so there is an added challenge to the quest for liberation that we have now that never existed in previous eras. However, that's the proof that we are very close to the end. You know, when the salmon leaps upstream, as it gets closer to the destination, it has to go against higher and higher cascades. And then it has to deal with shallower and shallower water that it can't swim through. And logs crossing it and all kinds of things, which are the equivalent of the shallowness of the ego and all of those logs of its jouissance and of its internal drive conflicts, etc., etc. But we are now at that moment of maximal difficulty. But because of that, paradoxically, since everything is a paradox, maximal benefit, maximal gain in capacity to transcend and to understand and the wisdom that can be gained from the challenge of silencing the mind and focusing on the God self without without distraction. Anyway, the book. The reason I'm choosing this book is that it is about three important themes. The book's title is Spirit in Ashes, Hegel, Heidegger, and Man-Made Mass Death. Okay? Now, why is that? I think it's obvious why that's important. We are now in a period of mass death. We are in a rolling apocalypse. We are in a time when we have already gone through stage one of mass death, which is still ongoing with the injection. We're about to go to phase two of mass death with food shortages, famines, and drought, and social collapse, and in Europe, freezing from lack of gas and oil that they have inflicted upon themselves, but mass death of an even higher and more dramatic nature that will not be the authorities won't be able to hide, nor do they have the intention of doing so. Their intention is to blame Russia and China and others, demonize others to be responsible, even though it is a self-inflicted wound. But the same social order that was inflicting death on its own people before is now doing it at a higher level, but wanting to be free of any blame, although it's pretty obvious what is really happening and how it's being engineered. Nonetheless, phase three will be the result of that demonization, which is war. So all the horsemen of the apocalypse are riding very fast, and because we are dealing with a situation of unprecedented mass death, this book that I think it was written in or published in 1998 for the first time, 1985 actually. So way before COVID, way before any of this, right? So this Visegrad was very prescient. She saw this coming. But moreover, she saw that Hegel saw this coming. Now to me, Hegel is the most important and probably the most intelligent philosophic thinker perhaps ever in the West, but certainly in modern times. I think he's so intelligent that hardly anyone understands. And he's been completely misunderstood, which is why there are so many schools based on Hegelian thought, but they're all in disagreement. Marxism is based on a misunderstanding of Hegelian dialectic and turned it into materialism, whereas Hegel is a mystic, a philosophic mystic, and his dialectic was the creation of an intellectual pathway from finite mind to infinite absolute spirit. And he realized that you can get to God consciousness through reason if you use reason accurately. He's a jnana yogi and probably the most intelligent of all. So intelligent that one of his rivals, Schopenhauer, said he's totally mad. I don't understand a word he says. I don't think it has any meaning. He didn't get it at all. And Schopenhauer was pretty intelligent. I actually like Schopenhauer. His book, The World as Will and Representation, is an incredible book in itself. But Hegel's IQ is so much higher that it's impossible almost for him to be understood. And his books have been translated by different people to try to grasp the meaning, but the words themselves are so polysemic. They have so many levels. Even the title of his first book, The Phenomenology of Geist, using the German word. Geist is often, it's either translated as phenomenology of mind or phenomenology of spirit. But the point is it's both. It is spirit functioning as mind, as the ability to think, but to think from the mind of God and to use that mind to overcome the finite ego mind. So it is total jnana yogi, which is why I think he achieved liberation, because I don't think he could have downloaded the insights that he did that are of an extraordinary and invaluable nature to a jnana yogi. I think he deserves the title of Sri Hegel, or Georg Wilhelm Friedrich, if you wish. But in any case, I think he was incredible as a thinker, and I hope you will find the same. And I've been trying to find an introductory book, because I can't inflict upon you the phenomenology of Geist directly without some introduction. This is not an introduction to Hegel, but there are enough allusions to Hegel in this book that are contextualized by comparing Hegel's writings with the poetry of Rilke, and then later the work of Heidegger, who is a 20th century phenomenologist who is already in a more fallen state, that I think enables you to appreciate what Hegel is really saying. So I think she has done an excellent job. Even though she's writing a scholarly work to other scholars, but I think she makes Hegel's intentions and the significance of his concise way of getting to the absolute truth accessible, even to someone who is not experienced in reading philosophic texts. At least I hope that's the case. We'll find out. This is an experiment. But the book is worth reading. And because it is about mass death, and she already sees that the logic of our situation, given the ego structure, given the tendencies that have already been shown to be in effect since the First World War and then the Second World War and concentration camps and the whole myth and story of the Holocaust, but it's both, and all of the wars following that, neo-colonial wars and wars of devastation, of the use of mass napalm and destruction of societies, whether in Vietnam, Libya, Syria, etc. The logic of it points already in 1985 to what we are now experiencing. And so the book is filled with very profound understanding of the meaning of the fall and redemption of the human spirit. And Hegel recognized it. And one of the things he said is that history is actually at an end because the soul is exhausted. Didn't mean that Hegel thought, you know, after Napoleon, who was then in charge of European politics, was the end of the world and the apocalypse. But he recognized that there could not be any further growth or development, that there was a decline and a contraction. And he was, I think, the high point of the first time that non-duality was fully realized in Western philosophy, at least since Plato or the classical Neoplatonic writers who were incorporated into Christian mysticism. But he is a non-dualist. But his non-duality is different from the non-duality of Buddhism or of Advaita, because he certainly achieves the neti neti, which is what the dialectic is. It's thesis and negation, negation of the ego, and then negation of the negation, which is negation of the soul by realizing the absolute. But what he understands is that the world itself is inherently paradoxical, and that paradox shows up to the ego mind as self-contradiction. And so it's only the ability to deal with contradiction that enables you to unify what otherwise to the ego mind cannot make sense. So when the Buddhists say nirvana is samsara, how can that make sense? How does the ego make sense of that? Or transcendence is immanence, or death is life. Yes, we are dead and alive simultaneously at this moment, because the ego is dead to the soul. And you only know the soul by going through ego death. And it's only when the ego is realized as being already dead, because it's just a program, it never had any life, that's its lack. It lacks being, it lacks essence. When you realize you're already dead, because you've never been born. But that death is deathlessness. And then you realize the absolute self by recognizing that both sides of this contradiction actually make a whole that is a unified truth that is no longer contradictory. But only when you realize you are simultaneously alive and dead, and then realize you are beyond both, and then can integrate the two and live in that state in which the integration and the unification of these opposites has been achieved truthfully, really, absolutely, in the way you live, in the state of security and freedom from anxiety that is the proof of it, and the capacity to live spontaneously, without inhibition, but also without exhibition. It's that absoluteness that has united those opposites and has united the opposites of fear and desire and gone beyond both. So Hegel has achieved that philosophically and understood it and teaches the mind how to gain non-duality. So for that reason, and Heidegger, who already goes back into, he loses belief in the absolute spirit. He's an atheist. And a nihilist, really. But he recognizes that this is where the world is in a state of fallenness. And he uses the word thrownness in Being and Time. We're thrown into this situation. We're shipwrecked here. We find ourselves in a world that we didn't make, and that we're victims of the situation. But we're also guilty, because somehow we're responsible, and we know that we lack something important, and so we go with a sense of existential guilt into the world and have to then live an inauthentic existence to hide that fact and to try to fill the lack from the validation of others. And that keeps us in a state of weakness and in a state of false consciousness. So Heidegger, I think, gives a very brilliant analysis of the ego as it is today, the postmodern ego, in fact, and of the evil of technology, because he also foresaw back in, well, by the end of World War II, when he was a political prisoner himself, which is when he read the Tao Te Ching and became a Taoist, and he became very very spiritual. He recognized that technology was going to be used to enslave the human race and destroy it. He said his final words were, "Only a God can save us." And so we must find that God within ourselves, not just a God, the God. But as Oppenheimer, the physicist, said when he saw the first explosion of the nuclear bomb in the Manhattan Project, which was a project created by supposedly former Nazi scientists who became to the U.S. And created atomic bombs and missiles, Wernher von Braun and others from Germany. He said, "I am become death." He quoted the Bhagavad Gita, which is indeed the vision of God as death, Mahakal, Shiva, the destroyer of worlds. And it is what Hegel realized when the truth of the nihilism of the human spirit that had already happened in the 1700s. He was born in 1770, lived to about 1830, and it was already in that period that he was speaking about the death of God in terms of the loss of connection to spirit in human consciousness. Nietzsche picked that up and said, "Haven't you heard that God is dead?" But it came from Hegel. But what Hegel meant was, God has now changed, because we don't pray to a God that's transcendent any longer. At least most people don't, and it's ridiculed by the scientism, consumerism, materialism, etc. of the mainstream. And even Christians mostly give lip service to it, and Jews and Muslims, that God has become death, and God can only appear as mass death. So although it seems evil to the ego, it is only the reflection of the ego's own evil rejection of God that forces God to come back as death, that brings us back to the truth of our eternal life, our eternal light that transcends the world. And so we have chosen to go through this cleansing at the end of time. We're not victims of an evil cabal creating an apocalyptic takeover of the human race. No, it is a self-chosen collective decision to activate the lower death drive and bring this about. But also the upper death drive is activated, and those who wish to achieve God must go through death voluntarily. Not death of the body, but death of the ego, to realize God as the great death, the death of death. And that is liberation. So that's what the book is about, and I think it's worth reading, actually. And I think that you will gain a tremendous amount by the contextualization of Hegel's writing with the current situation, and the poetry that she includes in the book, not only from Rilke but from others. And there's a poetic element to her prose, to her writing, and to the whole approach to this situation that I think is very extraordinary. That if you cultivate a taste for that, you will see that she is writing from a very high level of intelligence and able to explain, I think, very clearly what Hegel and Heidegger and Rilke and other sages and writers were getting at and have been trying to warn us all about and teach us in order to rise again to absolute spirit. So... I hope we can get the book. It's online, clearly, and it's also, get it at your local bookseller, if you wish, even better. But I assume we can have it for everyone in a week, and maybe we'll start reading it. And I will participate in it and lead some of the classes. Some I will actually ask people to present certain sections, the impact of it on them and their analysis of those sections. But I'll be here also and comment as well, because I think this is something that we have to think together about, to brainstorm about, to really go deeply into Hegel's ideas. Now, of course, not all of Hegel's ideas are in this book, only the ones relevant to this theme. And Hegel has written about everything: philosophy of religion, history, politics, theory of right, ethics, and art history, and the meaning of art, and you name it. He's a universal philosopher, but I think it gets to the core of what his mystical quest was about. How many people feel interested in reading the book after that? Yeah? Okay. Good. Wonderful. And I hope you'll be okay with being called upon to speak about the impact of it on you. And I think you'll actually find it readable and actually very exciting. And if you are interested in it, then we'll go deeper into Hegel afterwards in other books. By the way, Hegel, although he was almost completely misunderstood, there's a story. He used to hang out with Goethe, who was probably the major intellectual figure in Germany at the time. And Germany was the intellectual center of the Western world at that time. Absolutely no doubt about it. And one day, Goethe invited Hegel for lunch, and Goethe's daughter, who I think was either married already and an adult or at least a teenager, I'm not sure, this was from Goethe's own journal, but he invited Hegel for lunch, and they had this very formal conversation. And after Hegel left, the daughter said, "You know, I didn't understand a word that he said." And Goethe said, "Don't worry, no one does." And it has been that way. But in the 20th century, Hegel was rediscovered by a group of Japanese philosophers, Zen philosophers, who incorporated Hegel, who made an integration of Hegelian thought into Zen and created a whole new school of thought. It's called the Kyoto School of Philosophy. Nishida Kitaro and Keiji Nishitani and Masao Abe and others have written incredible books that I would also like to share and explore in a book group. So I hope you're open to all of that, because even though, and well, maybe because we don't have much time left, I think if we intensify our intellectual understanding of the state of soul consciousness and that of the absolute self, it will be easier to go from the symbolic to the supreme real, rather than try to get there from the imaginary register of the ego, which is impossible, which is what I think most people have been attempting and failing miserably and then feeling worse. And since you're not all ready to just be in silence, which would be an even better way of approaching it, but since you do tend to divert your attention into the internet and other things, this will force you to spend your evenings reading and studying. So this is my heuristic way of trying to force you to focus on the main task of being a satyogi, which is dialectically reasoning yourself out of ego consciousness into the soul and into the pure absolute self. Okay, I think that's all I need to say about the book and about Edith Wishegrad and about the book group. The people who are visiting, it's optional for you, but if we can offer it, we'll at least recorded and have the book group available, and maybe we'll Zoom it. We'll see. We'll have to talk about that and see if there is enough interest. But I do think that it is useful to read, even if you're here only a short time, because this is something that I think the soul will be nourished by. Okay, floor is open if anyone has any responses to any of that.
Tara?
Question. I'm excited about the book, and I like to be put into some, as you said, you know, my mind will just go off onto watching endless videos on YouTube, so having some homework is always useful.
You'll probably start watching videos on Hegel, but...
I actually tried that a few months ago, and I just couldn't quite...
Most of them are bad, but if you insist, I'll recommend a few.
Okay. One thing that did excite me, and maybe I misunderstood, so I want to double-check. Were you saying that Hegel's version, let's say, or understanding of non-duality, he put it in more in terms of integrating contradictions? Is that what you were saying? Because kind of, I don't know, gave me another way of looking at non-duality. Because even when I hear non-duality, I'm like, that's not the path I'm on. Like, I'm focusing on something else. And when I heard integrating contradictions, that sounds like what I feel I'm wanting from life, like wanting to find that harmony in between all the crazy contradictions. So it just really excited me. It kind of made me like the idea of non-duality if it's in those terms.
That's why I think he's useful specifically for the Western postmodern ego structure, which is a mass of self-contradictions because of its internal conflicts, right? And he will teach you how to integrate those and have a unified will and have a will to transcend the contradictions, but to see them clearly as contradictions and not fight them and not have to choose one side or the other, because that's the mistake you always make, right? It's either A or B. No, it's actually both. But how can it be both when they're opposites? Well, it can be, because everything is its own opposite. You are your own opposite. Because you are always different from the you were even a moment ago. Every moment you're learning something new and you're different, even though you may not notice that, but there is a difference. Every bit of information you get changes the wholeness of the database upon which you develop your understanding of experience, right? So there is a way in which you know you are both your ego and not your ego, because you're aware of your ego's contradictions, and by being aware of it, you know you're not there, because you see both sides of it, and you say, I'm not sure which, but you're neither of them. And then you can go from neither to the integration of both. Okay?
Another thing that I've been obsessing a bit recently is this whole transgender movement. And there was a couple of things. Well, this whole thing about the contradiction, like if you're in an ego state and you're wanting the opposite, then there's no sense of being able to step out of it and recognizing you don't need to go and change your gender to experience the opposite. Anyway, that's a whole other topic. But when you mentioned Hegel had said this, I think you said it was Hegel said, the soul is exhausted and then there can't be further growth in that realm. It helps me, or it made me understand, of course, like if you're not focused, if you're not even able to access the soul and you don't realize that there's that part of you, then all you can advance in is this kind of phenomenal plane level and change yourself on this level as if that's going to make one happy, and not just transgender, but in all these other ways of changing one's physical body to try and be something different instead of, I imagine, in a time where one was had that connection to spirit, or at least the soul level, there was growth going on in the soul, such as you introducing, reading this book to us, like, you know, advancing the mind, advancing the soul, connecting, not worrying about all these ridiculous things on the phenomenal plane. Anyway.
Okay.
It wasn't really a question, it was just rambling.
No, very good insights. I'm glad you're activating your reflections and your capacity to think. That's exactly what this is about. And this will mobilize your ability to transcend those contradictions. So thank you. And I appreciate
thank you.
Your intellectual curiosity and interest in growth and spiritual development, and that will create a positive cycle of development to transcendence. Okay? Thank you. Anyone else want to say anything? Ah, Ken.
Thank you for sharing this. I'm really excited to read it, mostly because I've been reading one book by Wolfgang Gigerich.
He's a Hegelian.
Yeah. I would have figured, yeah.
Yeah. He integrated Hegel with Carl Jung, who was an anti-Hegelian, and he's still alive. He's using Hegel to develop an entirely new kind of psychology of the soul, not of the ego, and of the real soul, not of the image of the soul, not the imaginary version that Jung unfortunately fell for because he was interested in images. So, yeah. Good. I'm glad you're reading. What are you reading of Gigerich?
It was Dialectics and Psychoanalytic.
Right. It was a seminar that he held.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes. In some canyon, right. El Capitan, I believe.
Yeah. It was in California. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a good start. Mm-hmm. Then there are more serious... Read his collected papers. That's what I would suggest next.
Okay. I'll keep it in mind.
Okay.
There was one idea that... stuck with me from reading it, and I believe you pointed somewhat to it when talking about God being dead, and so God only being able to appear as massive death. Mm-hmm. And it was this point on the bomb, the nuclear bomb, which was another book that I started reading, but it became a little bit too dense to continue, too heavy as well, I think. But there was this point where he mentioned that he said the bomb is God now, and basically because we pushed God off totally into transcendence and away from the world, God had to sort of center himself into this thing. And then he mentioned the idea of sort of doing rituals around the bomb and all of this in order to, I don't know, I guess as I understood it, and I don't think I fully did, but in order to gain more acceptance of it, and so I don't know. I was wondering if you think there's anything to that idea.
No, I think that's in the imaginary already.
Okay, so
that's why I don't think Gigerich has risen to the full level of Hegel. I think he got something from Hegel, but Hegel didn't stop at the soul. Gigerich stops at the soul and doesn't want to know about the absolute. Mm-hmm. So he still falls into the imaginary because he's still in duality. And he defines psychology as the discipline of interiority. But for the absolute, there's no interiority because there's no exteriority. There's nothing outside the self. And so you have to go beyond interiority as a concept. Yes, at first you go inward. You extract yourself from the externalization of the ego. That's step one. But then there's an integration of the imperience and the experience into the sumerience. And until you've gone through that integration of, yes, I'm a subject, and I'm also an object, a me, I'm an I and a me in the world, right? I'm an object to others as a body, that's how they see me, but I know that I'm not that, and I'm pure mind and intelligence and love and all those things, right? They don't get that, and they project on me, and right, I'm unhappy because no one understands me, and right, all of those, right, self-contradictions. But you have to go beyond both of those in order to realize the self, and then you're disidentified even from thinking of yourself as a localized entity, because the absolute self is non-local, everywhere and nowhere.
Thank you. Yeah, it kind of reminds me of this, like that's where the effort comes from, is this trying to interiorize and trying to internalize everything constantly. But then I feel that what you're saying is, in the realization that all falls away, and so then the effortlessness really arises.
Yes.
Because there's no more struggle to go through that dialectic process, I guess. But
well, you've completed it. Mm. Once you reach the absolute, there's nothing more to negate. You've done it.
Thank you, Shinya. Right. Looking forward.
Okay, great. Anyone else? Oh, Nirgun.
Thank you, Shunya. It's actually a comment from Henrietta, who is halfway through her travels to get here. And so we're delighted that she can be with us tonight. She says, "The inside of Geist creates a space in my thinking, and I feel that it needs another level to approach to it. So I'm looking forward to these teachings."
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Henrietta. I'm looking forward to your arrival, and I'm sure you'll have a lot to contribute to our conversations. Thank you. Anyone else? Nimrod.
Thank you, Shunya. I am also very excited to go into these teachings. I've been curious about Hegel and intimidated for a while. It's a bit of a tangent. I was wondering, in the context of Hegel, the dialectical movement through history, what's your take on Ken Wilber and the integral school and spiral dynamics and this kind of take of the same movement, dialectical movement?
Well, I find some issues with that. I think they've fallen into a certain imaginary version of that. And once you read Hegel's version, you'll see the difference. But it's too complex to try to give you a summary in a few minutes. But Hegel does go through the history of the development of our psychology, our response to the experience of being in the world, and how we go through a stoic period and a skeptic period and a period of the discontent, the unhappy soul he talks about, and the beautiful soul. And he talks about all the different steps, which you can compare to the Kundalini map, to all the different assemblage points, actually, on the interior journey. So it's both history and it's our own ontology, you know, that's being replicated by ontogeny. But it's a kind of a map that I think is much more profound in its understanding of the nature of consciousness than the levels that Wilber gets to in his map. That's all I would say. And I think a lot of Buddhists have the same critique of Wilber, that he's dealing with a faux transpersonalism, because it's still within the person. It's not a complete integration. And a complete dialectical achievement of non-duality, but you know that's something that I would want to go through a Wilber text with you to do justice to Wilber as well, and see what I do think are some very important insights that he offers as well. Okay. No one else? No? Oh, okay. Take the mic.
Well, in the interview yesterday, I think I mentioned it to you, I was very happily surprised to see that Mark, who was visiting with us, asked this question about critical thinking and how he felt as he was interviewing you that the world had lost this ability for critical thinking, and as you were presenting this book and the opportunity, I feel that there's excitement about learning, growing. So the epistemophilic drive that we all carry is ignited by your sharing, but there's also a little ego voice saying, "Oh my gosh, am I going to understand?" You know, there's kind of this fear of, "Can I even follow these kinds of thoughts, right? Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that we have grown up, all of us here present, in a society that, as Mark was mentioning, has completely poo-pooed critical thinking, made fun of it, mm-hmm. And has almost forced all of us. I'm speaking for myself. I shouldn't speak for everyone, but I know that in my case, trying to reason and using reason and logic, and this association of thoughts, was actually frowned upon. And so it seems to me that there's a part of myself for sure, and I wonder if, as a collective, where we have to awaken that.
Yeah, you will. You'll have to awaken it from, not only awaken it, but defeat the resistance to it. Because mm-hmm. there's a command mm-hmm. not to think. However, let me correct you. This book is not about critical thinking. It has nothing to do with critical thinking. Critical thinking is phenomenal plane thinking. That's the kind of thinking that Hegel was refuting and saying, this is why Kant was a nihilist. Because you can't get to God with critical thinking. You can understand politics with critical thinking. You can understand the lies, you know, you can understand how medical misinformation and you shouldn't trust the science, you know. You can be critical about that because no real scientist would ever trust the science. That's what science is distrust and re-experimentation and always changing your hypotheses as new evidence arises. Never trust. That's what science is based on, right? Suspicion, distrust. Always, I'll find out for myself. I'll do my own due diligence, right? So, yes, critical thinking is important. And every ego should get that in childhood, all right? But this is dialectical reason, not critical thinking. And it's not the dialectic of Plato and Socrates, which was still within the phenomenal plane of the questioning of how do we know what we know, epistemological thinking, right? This is different than that. This is how do you move from finite mind to infinite mind, right? And to God's form of reasoning, not our form of reasoning. So it's an entire divorce from critical thinking into a higher kind of mind that doesn't need to use critical thinking. Okay, so.
Well, that makes it even more interesting.
It also makes it easier because there's no resistance to that. You were only to resist the critical level. But not this, because it wasn't even in the field of possibility. Mm-hmm. However, your fear of failure will come into play, mm-hmm. and you should invite it, okay? You should invite it, because if you are really reading it carefully, you will not understand it. If you think you understand it, that's when you failed. Really, I'm serious. You have to recognize that you don't get it because it's self-contradictory, and critical thinking can't get it, and then say, okay, I have to negate my tendency to use critical thinking, because you do use critical thinking, but only in certain areas, right? But this is a critique of critical thinking, mm-hmm. in which that whole use of the mind is negated to understanding how does the soul see it, not how does the ego see it. Okay? That's the shift that will be so difficult. But you have to be to accept failure and frustration and all of that. Because if you don't go through that, you won't gain the truth. This is like a Zen koan, a massive Zen koan for 200 pages or whatever, that it's one riddle after another, and you have to be able to transcend that by exhausting the attempt to understand it critically and understand it dialectically instead. Okay? I hope that's of help.
Okay, very much looking forward to it.
Because that's how you get to non-duality.
Yeah, the two polarities together, mm-hmm. and holding them together, yes. Negation of negation.
Yes, and although the ego won't get it, the soul does get it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to get the negation of the not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go through not getting it in order to get it.
Great, thank you.
I hope that's useful to everyone. Okay, Amrita.
Thank you. Is that what you were just explaining, dialectic reasoning? Because I've never really quite understood, like, how what is that and how that works. That's what you were explaining?
Uh-huh, yeah. It's going from the finite to the infinite. And, of course, nobody gets it. It's not taught. Karl Marx didn't get it. He thought he was doing dialectical materialism. He wasn't. He was only doing critical thinking on that level. And he completely misunderstood Hegel and turned it into class warfare and all of that. It's not Hegel, what Hegel was talking about. He was talking about the warfare between ego and the God self, not that the soul had fallen asleep. So the dialectic is thinking from the soul, not from the ego. All right? And you have to negate the ego's thoughts. So yes, everything the ego thinks about this will be frustration, and I don't get it, and it must be wrong, and I'm wrong, and I'm stupid, and all of those thoughts, and you have to then see you're not the ego that's thinking that. And then when you get to the negation of that, you'll suddenly understand Hegel. Okay? But you will have to not be yourself in order to understand Hegel, not be your ego self. Because your ego self resists getting it because it doesn't want to get it. Because if you really get what Hegel is saying, you will go through ego death. And your ego doesn't want to do that. Right? So that's why the dialectic, you have to die to be elected to that level of consciousness.
So actually the contradiction within the ego is not actually the dialectical process. It's not like trying to go understand both sides to go beyond.
That's how it'll start. But then you'll realize that that's still within the frame of reference of duality. And then both of those will be negated. See, there'll be a thesis, right? Which they often say thesis, antithesis. Hegel never used those terms, actually. But you will recognize that the conflict you're in at the ego level between two polarities, you're aware of both of those, and then you'll transcend it and say, well, actually, I don't want either one of these, but I also want both of them. But how do I get that? You can only get that from another plane in which you recognize that what you want is actually something that is contained in both of them. But either of the two positions is not what you want. You want what you think you will get by getting what those positions apparently offer. And that's when you'll get to the real, because the two positions are both in the imaginary, right? So it's going from the imaginary to the real symbolic and then to the real, the supreme real. So it's an entirely different way of processing your experience, vertically rather than horizontally. Okay, you only get it by not getting it and going through the frustration. That's like with the Zen koan. This really is Zen. That's why the Zen philosophers were very happy to finally understand what they were doing with their koans, because they didn't know, you know, why are we telling these riddles, you know? But now there's the logic of the koan is really what Hegel figured out. Okay, well, if there's no other questions, we will adjourn until tomorrow night's satsang. Namaste. Maybe we'll meet next week for our first book group, if you have the books planned.
We have a retreat.
Oh. Well, I'll give you an assignment to read after the retreat, and then we'll have our first book group.
It'll take you a few days to read the first chapter.